I just want to acknowledge the land that we are on, Onondaga land, and for those of you here who live here who honor that every day with your work and your intention. I remember the first time where I live in Ithaca, New York, that a woman whose family is indigenous recognized the land where I live as Cayuga land in Haudenosaunee territory. It kind of blew my mind. And it changed so much for me. And so I appreciate the practice of just vocalizing that, because I think it opens up possibilities to do better with that relationship. And so thank you for practicing that. So I'm here to talk about King's Bay plowshares. And I'm going to start with a story that centers a lot of our friend Jun-san. Jun-san is a Japanese Buddhist nun in the order of Nipponzan Myohoji. And for those of you who don't know her, this order of nuns and monks, they pray, they walk, they chant, they beat the drum as their practice for world peace and particularly for nuclear disarmament. I first met Jun-san in the early 80s when she and about 40 others had walked from the west coast of Turtle Island to New York on the last leg of their journey to the UN for the UN Special Session on Disarmament in 1982. And the next time I met Jun-san was here in Syracuse. And one of the many things I've learned about the monks and nuns of Nipponzan Myohoji is that they have very specific instruction. Wherever they go, their first relationships are to be with First Nation and Indigenous people. And so the second time we met each other, she was living at Onondaga Nation with Dennis Banks. So she had, with those instructions, come to Turtle Island as a young nun, Buddhist nun, and her first relationships with Indigenous people, doing the longest walk one from Alcatraz to Bureau of Indian Affairs. And during that time, she became very close with Dennis Banks, one of the founders of the American Indian movement. And it was Jun-san, I learned later, who was instrumental in gaining sanctuary for Dennis and his wife at the time, Kamuk, and their children at Onondaga Nation. It was not an easy thing for the people to welcome Dennis, who came with the possibility of the feds invading their sovereign and safe place, as I had heard the story told. So Jun-san was living at Onondaga Nation when the Griffiths plowshares were on trial at the federal courthouse here. Seven of us had gone to Griffiths Air Force Base, the home at that time of the cruise missile. Well, they were re-outfitting B-52 bombers to carry nuclear-tipped cruise missiles, first strike weapons. And we went on Thanksgiving Day of 1983, and we disarmed this B-52 bomber and its related parts. By the way, that weapon system was inoperable for 5 months afterwards. It was a nonviolent symbolic action that had this dimension to it. So we were facing a charge of sabotage and destruction of government property, and we were facing 25 years in prison, and the seven of us co-defendants were staying with Fred Daly in Syracuse here, and Jun-san would walk every day, or at least in the beginning, from Onondaga Nation to downtown Syracuse and pray and fast at the courthouse for that five-week trial. So we got to know each other, even without a lot of conversation. And that trial resulted in not guilty on the sabotage charge, but conviction on the charge of destruction of government property. And so I was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. Some of my co-defendants who were more educated got 3 years. The judge said that was somehow connected. So before sentencing, I remember Jun-san inviting me to Onondaga Nation, and she took me out in the back field of the house where she was staying and showed me the three sisters growing there, the corn, bean, and the squash. And then as we were about to leave, Dennis and a bunch of other guys were about to go out on their run. And so we didn't have a lot of conversation, but it was a formative moment. And every moment that I spend with Jun-san, I try to pay attention to the gift that's being given to me that I want to honor So I spent my prison time in Alderson, West Virginia, and then I was in a halfway house in my old neighborhood in the Lower East Side of New York. And after that, moved back to Ithaca at some point. Yeah, my mother got sick. So over the years since that time, I haven't applied myself with organizing for nuclear disarmament. And probably like many of you, it kind of took a back burner because other things that we had not attended to, like our relationship with First Nation people, Indigenous people, undoing racism, and so many other things kind of just whooshed to the front. And the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists told us that we weren't 3 minutes to midnight anymore. So we had like little breath. So we were attending to other things. But at all times, war was on the front burner, and how war was killing us here and abroad. So aside from joining a few walks with June Sun, calling for a nuclear-free future, I have done little with that in a very specific way for nuclear disarmament. But I took part in an action in 2003 with fellow Ithaca Catholic workers, a nonviolent symbolic action where we poured blood and knelt and prayed at the local recruiting office saying no to the escalated war in Iraq. And many of you here were part of that effort. Everywhere you lived, we were all coming to the streets and doing whatever we could with our hearts and our hands and our heads. Notably, that action came from a collective, a community and a collective. And that action was also for me a faith, part of my faith journey. Everything that I'm telling you is part of my faith journey. So that was called the St. Patrick's Four Action. And I got out of prison. Well, we had two trials. We had a county trial in Ithaca, and then we got a hung jury, and then we had a federal trial in Binghamton, and we were convicted of the smaller charges, and we spent some time in federal prison. So when I came home from prison in 2006, my life took a little turn in Ithaca, where I live. There were two events that were really pivotal for me. One was a friend of my family's, Paul and my friend Amelia, called us to say that her daughter was experiencing racial attacks on the school bus. She was 12 years old. Her name is Epiphany, by the way. Epiphany and her mother Amelia moved from the Bronx, which was a bonding point for us because I'm also from the Bronx. And we'd spend time together, hanging out, going on picnics, being at the community kitchen. And I didn't really have the sense of what life was like on the school bus for Epiphany. But she was experiencing repeated racial attacks. And her mom, Amelia, was calling the school district to ask for remediation of this abuse. And she wasn't getting any satisfaction. So she went to the Human Rights Commission and tried to sue the school board. And that really birthed one of many moves in Ithaca, where I live, for racial justice. So there was a little burst of movement with leaders of color and Amelia leading us to consider what equity in the schools would look like and what racism looks like for people of color in our town. So without planning it, I was grateful to engage in that struggle. And then in February of 2010, just down the hill from where I live on Elm Street in Ithaca, a white police officer shot and killed a black man named Sean Greenwood on February 23rd in 2010. And I looked out the window of where I live, and I saw, and I said, something just happened at Pete's, the gas station where this happened. And Paul looked out the window. He said, oh, there must have been an accident. And I said, oh, no. The police just did something bad because they're forming a line and they're showing their power right now. And that means something. And so just in my gut and intuition and my life experience told me there was something sinister there. Well, the following years were spent with groups like friends that were friends of color that said, we need to do something. And it began about 5 years of work seeking justice for Sean Greenwood. And during that time, I saw up close the parallel with this stuff about calling for the end of war, calling for the upholding of the supreme laws of our land, to not wage a war of aggression, to not kill civilians, to not steal people's land, to not poison their water. All of these things came into focus when we were seeking justice for Sean Greenwood. Realized the truth was hard to find. It wasn't even just lost, it was being kept out. And it was being kept out by the public servants who we actually pay to tell the truth and to uphold justice. And it was so troubling, the extent to which the lies just kept piling up on top of each other, and the extent to which every one of us in our town were playing our part and were required to be complicit in this sin. Not, you know, the police officer, God rest his, God, he's not dead, he's alive, but he's tortured. My friend, a friend just told me how she bumped into him the other day. But how that shooting then was multiplied by the legitimizing of the killing afterwards, and people saying, oh, he was a drug dealer, oh, he was playing with fire, oh, the police had to do it because they didn't have a choice. And it was shocking how many fellow white people didn't even question that maybe the police weren't telling the truth. It felt like Undoing Racism 101 in 2010. Like, oh, we need some work here. So we had a little group called the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. It was really more like the Truth and Accountability. And we got the police report, and we studied it for about a year and a half, and we wrote to the Justice Department. This was all pre-Black Lives Matter, pre-Trayvon Martin's killing and Mike Brown. And so we were experiencing this, like, oh, we're seeking justice in, like, this is like the tiniest little scream of thousands and millions of screams for justice for this very thing. How do we even think we're going to find justice for this? I could talk at length about that experience, so I'm just going to say, during the 12 years between 2006 and 2018, when I took up with my friends, did this action at Kings Bay, virtually all my energy was spent, organizing was spent collectively for racial justice in the town where I lived. But at the same time, thanks to Ed and Anne and Ellen and others, there was an ongoing campaign at Hancock Airfield to ground the drones and stop the wars and stop the killing. And I was grateful that they were doing all the hard work of footwork of having it happen, and I would show up and get arrested and spend some time in the Justice Center downtown here in Syracuse and the Ville. Yeah, the Ville. So I had some time in the jails up here. And it was a combination of things, and maybe I'll just add this little parenthesis. One of my friends and neighbors, also from the Bronx, living next door, her husband was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And I would go with her and her little son to try to go visit him at the various prisons he was moved to. And we would go to Attica when he was there for a while. And one time I was sitting in the parking lot. We had gone in for the visit, and I'd come out early to give them alone time. And I'm sitting outside those vast walls. If you have ever been to Attica, I recommend it. And I was there watching Shift Change. And I just had this image. So I had already been to federal prison twice and jails a lot, and I just started imagining this, the numbers of people in our criminal justice system, which is over 2 million, and I started to tally of all the people in U.S. prisons and jails and county jails and jail, how many of them, how many people they're said to have killed. Let's put that up on a graph, and how many people they've said to have stole, how much money they've stolen, and let's put that up on a graph. And then let's take the big crime of killing millions and stealing trillions and put that up on a graph. And we will see so clearly what the real crime is and who the real criminals are. And my tail wagged when I saw the Syracuse Peace Council's newsletter one time have a graphic that showed the bars and it said, what is the real crime or something? Who is, anyway, I was like, I was desperate to have the truth of that just shouted as often as possible. So I'm in a jail cell one time in the Justice Center here in Syracuse waiting to go to court, and I'm writing my notes in this freezing cold cell. Seems like I'm always freezing in jail. And I'm getting clarity, because that's what happens to me in jail and prison. I get new vision. And I have this epiphany that there's a corollary for me. To the extent that those of us of privilege don't hold the big crime of killing millions and stealing trillions accountable, we will continue to scapegoat those who are on the receiving end of these big crimes. We will continue to call farmers in Afghanistan terrorists. And we will continue to call young men and women here who are trying to make a living because there's no other option offered, criminals. I don't allow people to say the word terrorist in front of me unless they're talking about real terrorism. And I don't allow people to use the word criminal in front of me unless we're willing to have a conversation about real crime. So with that, and I'm not saying for one minute that there isn't harm and hardship and that people are using guns and killing each other and that we need remedies, but I'm in a 12-step program with Al-Anon, and I totally believe that once I take care of my business, that I open up spiritual space for other people to take care of their own healing. I don't have to take someone on as a project. I'm not here to fix you. I'm here to clean up my side of the street. And it's been unattended for so long. And the scam is that I've been calling you the criminal and you the terrorist all along, not minding my own business. So while I was not disarming nuclear weapons for many years, or even organizing, or even following the details of every single development in nuclear disarmament work like I can, I said yes to this process that led to my work, to my participation in the Kings Bay Plowshare 7. I said yes to it because I understood that these weapons are like the capstone, the biggest bully stick in a weaponized system that enforces white supremacy globally and enforces global capitalism. And both those things take lives and hearts and minds and bloodshed every day. Every day. So, unlike how I might have felt in my young early 20s, where that atomic clock was going 3 minutes to midnight and people were having that wake-up call of, oh, we might blow this whole thing up, I'm not just here before you as a Plowshares activist because I'm worried if they launch these weapons. I know they're being used every day. And I know just the way you use a gun, when you hold a gun to someone's head, that's using the gun. We are using this gun every day, and it's upholding this deadly, wicked, sinful system. And so, I am really grateful that I am with these seven people. We're all Catholic. That you don't have to be Catholic. I hope you are wherever you come from, but I just happen to be Catholic. I'm going to jump now to some of my notes that I recently pulled together for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act defense and our motion to dismiss our current charges based on that. And I'm going to read to you from Mark's Gospel, chapter 12. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is Lord alone. You shall love the Lord God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Nuclear weapons eviscerate and violate the possibilities of loving God and neighbor. We cannot build, possess, maintain, and threaten to use nuclear weapons and love God as if God were Lord alone. Loving God requires trusting God and reverencing the sacredness of all God's creation. Nuclear weapons have become an idol, replacing the love of God with the willingness to threaten and destroy all of God's creation in the illusory pursuit of maintaining power and control. This greatest commandment from Mark's Gospel that links love of God with love of neighbor gets more specific in the Gospel of Matthew 25. Whatsoever you do to the least of your neighbors, whoever is around, you do to me, Jesus, God. Church teaching is clear on that. Also, as a Catholic, I believe that my particular faith is an incarnational religion, that the Word was made flesh, and that as part of our practice, we eat the bread and drink the wine, the body and the blood of Christ. We are called to manifest our love of God and neighbor. This means that we cannot pray for peace and drop bombs at the same time. We cannot pray for peace and pay for bombs at the same time. And we cannot pray for peace and let others drop bombs in our name. Knowing and believing all this leaves us with choices. The prophet Isaiah offers us a way to hammer swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. This is where the musical ensemble is supposed to come in with tubas. Sorry, I didn't bring them with us. Next time. So there is a sequence for me in Isaiah. First, we stream to the mountaintop for instruction. And that instruction, by the way, is written on our hearts. And it's for everybody. It's not just Catholics or Christians, or, you know. And that then we hammer swords into plowshares. There's this actual, real, physical step manifesting this new relationship. And then at the final line, which many people leave out, it's my favorite line, then we walk in the light of the Creator. That's when we have this new relationships in this adjusted relationship. So hammering the trident weapon system, clipping a lock, going over the fence, hammering the monuments, hammering the concrete there, is my physical effort in community to withdraw my consent from this system, this weapon system that exists in my name, unless I do something to change that relationship. It exists in my name. So hammering dents in the monuments is one step. Carefully pouring blood on the ground is an act of truth-telling while also withdrawing consent. It reveals the bloodshed. It also is a symbol of atonement. And we brought Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. We brought spray paint, and I spray-painted Disarm Trident, Love One Another. We brought crime scene tape. We put that up front of the door to the administration building. So our nonviolent symbolic act of disarmament seeks to withdraw consent from the Trident weapon system and the systems of theft and domination that the Trident enforces. Our action itself reveals the willingness of each of us actors to put our trust in God, not in the idolatrous weapons, but to offer our lives to be transformed, not by force, but by seeking to trust in the will of God. The invitation by Jesus to love one another as I have loved you is an invitation to a disarmed life. This kind of love does not force itself. It does not bear arms, does not threaten harm. It is with this spirit that we went to Kings Bay. So at this moment, so we were arrested at Kings Bay on April 5th, the night of April 5th. And Liz McAllister, who many of you know, who's in her 80th year, she likes to say, she has been in jail in South Georgia ever since then. And that's a pretty harsh place to be. Steve Kelly, Father Steve Kelly, who's 70, will be 70 in a week or so, has also been in jail since that action. And Mark Colville, who came out briefly for surgery on cancer on his nose, went back in recently, and he is there in jail in South Georgia. And the stage we're at right now with our case is that we're still in pretrial stage, motions hearings, and we have not completed the motions to dismiss the charges against us. We ask that the charges be dismissed based on the fact that these weapons violate all the supreme laws of our land, commonly understood as international laws. I like to call them the supreme laws of our domestic situation. And that they should dismiss the charges because our actions were not only justified but required in the face of this big crime. And the third thing that we presented in our motion to dismiss was Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that our act was motivated and fully embodied our religious practice. Those of us Catholics who practice nonviolent symbolic disarmament at the scene of the sin, at the scene of the crime, with a very incarnational practice. And so we presented arguments in early August, and the judge, Magistrate Baker at the time, said, "Tell me more about that." So we were all asked to write affidavits, and that's when you realize some of us don't write very easily. But I light a candle and pray to the Holy Spirit, and then I try to close the door and not answer the phone. So we all wrote affidavits that were submitted to the court, volumes of writing, which is on the website, by the way. Then we got to come into court and testify from the stand. So we had 2 days of hearings in November where each of us took the stand and testified to our firmly held religious beliefs and how the government's prosecution of us with 3 felonies and a misdemeanor, 25 years worth of charges, burdens the practice of our religious belief. And the government has to prove that they have a compelling interest to protect and that they've used the least restrictive means possible to protect that compelling interest. We say that nuclear weapons are illegal and illegitimate, and they are not a legitimate compelling interest, and that you have charged us with 3 felonies and a misdemeanor, and that is not the least restrictive way to proceed. And the captain of the base who was on the stand for the government, he blew a hole in the government's case when he was asked by one of our lawyers, when a person who's doing a religious practice on the base comes and does their practice on the base, do you treat them any differently than anyone else? And he said, "Oh, not at all. Not at all. Apparently you're supposed to under this Religious Freedom Restoration Act." I have never encountered this act close up, and it has some kind of, it's fraught with a lot of challenges for many of us, but it was encouraged to try because we've had doors closed again and again, bringing up the laws, bringing up the justification, and the lawyers thought maybe we could redeem the RFRA, as it's called in short. My co-defendant Patrick chooses to call it RFRA. Sorry. Patrick, that was for you. So I could talk more about that if there are questions later, but right now it looks like we are not going to trial till at least the middle of February. And all 7 of us will be working with a team of lawyers, some going pro se with standby counsel and some fully represented. And we welcome everyone that wants to come to trial to come to South Georgia.